And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome Mary Kay Andrews, author of Sunset Beach. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. The book is the latest from the New York Times bestselling author and combines murder, family secrets, with home renovation. Well, welcome back, Mary Kay. We're so glad to have you today. And I know Sunset Beach is your latest, but you have a lot of books out there. And it's been a long time since I talked to you, because I think the last time you were here was for a Fixer Upper.
Wow, that has been a long time.
Yeah, and you've written a cookbook since then, which I was excited about. How did that go?
The Beach House cookbook went great. Still selling. We're still cooking out of it, so it's all good.
Well, we collect cookbooks, so that's one I'm going to have to look for.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. But I know in this book, Sunset Beach, you said it took you back home.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm a native of St. Pete, Florida. Grew up there, and my mom's whole family lived there. And I guess I had been waiting for a chance to write about that specific place. Sunset Beach is a real small beach community on the Gulf Coast of Florida, right outside of St. Pete. This whole book is sort of a Valentine to my hometown. I indulged myself and used several places in the book that are places that were meaningful to me. There's a sentimental tie. Sunset Beach was a place. I had an older cousin, and when he got back from Vietnam, he and his child bride, she was 17 when they married, moved to Sunset Beach and lived in a little, literally a garage. And it was such an exotic place to me. I was still a younger teen. And Sunset Beach was the hippie beach in the 70s when I was a kid. And it was a place where oddballs and down and out types lived. So it was an exotic place to me when I was a kid. And so the book switches back and forth in time from current times to 1972.
And is that the time that you would have been spending time there?
Yeah, I graduated from high school in 1972.
That's the Colleen story.
Yes, that's the Colleen.
And Colleen disappeared.
She does.
Now, Drew Campbell has been forced, basically,
right,
to move back home because she has nothing else.
Right. She's out of options. Her parents divorced when she was quite young and living in St. Pete. And she moves over to the west coast of Florida with her mom. She's a kiteboarder, and she's had a career-ending sports injury. And that sports injury also means she's gotten fired from her job as a waitress at a beach bar. And she's broken up with her boyfriend, which means she's now homeless, and her mom's just passed away. So, yeah, she's at a dead end. And then her father, long-estranged father, who hasn't been in her life since she was a teenager, very surprisingly appears at her mother's funeral and sort of throws her a lifeline.
And so she moves to Sunset Beach.
Right. He offers her a job at his law firm. He is one of those flamboyant personal injury lawyers. He offers her a job and gives her the news, which is a total shock to her, that she's inherited her grandparents' beach cottage on Sunset Beach. And that's a place that's very sentimental for her. She spent time there every summer as a kid, spent a couple weeks, would go back home to Sunset Beach from Fort Lauderdale and spend a couple weeks with her grandparents. Her grandfather built this cottage. He was a maintenance worker in a cigar factory in Tampa. So Drew is actually half Cuban on her mom's side. So the news that she has a home, she's never owned a home of her own. So that comes sort of as a shock to her. And of course, the bigger shock is when she discovers that it's a pretty battered, beat up cottage.
Now that you said it used to be the hippie beach,
right,
I know where the character Leonard must have come from.
Right.
I found him fascinating. I really wanted to know more about him because he just sounded like such an odd character. But he also sort of reminded me of one of the characters in your last book, the High Tide Club, the maintenance guy,
mm-hmm,
you know, the boat kind of
right,
guy
yeah,
that took him back and forth. Those kind of characters kind of stick with me, I guess, for some reason.
Yeah, I like those oddball characters. And you never really see Leonard in Sunset Beach. You just hear about him, the fact that he likes to sunbathe in the nude until he's forced to, because of appearances, he's forced to make himself a loincloth out of washcloths.
You could tell everybody around there knew who he was,
yeah,
and about him and everything.
I like those kind of oddball characters. I don't know that I try. They just show up. And
yeah.
I really kind of had to work at not letting him have more of a part because I had a lot of other plot to pack into that book.
Yes, you did. And not only is there the disappearance of Colleen.
Right.
But then we also have a murder.
Yeah. So you have two cold cases that are intertwined throughout the plot of the book. There's a young woman. She's a housekeeper at a resort hotel on Sunset Beach. And she's found murdered in the laundry room at the hotel. And Drew's father has been hired to try to sue the hotel for criminal negligence or wrongful death. But he's not successful in that. He can only help the young woman's mother file a workers' comp claim, because in Florida, workers' comp claims are limited statutorily to a certain amount of money. So Drew's working in the law firm, and one day the grandmother, and of course she's not really very old, she's, I guess, in her 40s. She had her daughter young, and her daughter had a daughter young, and the grandmother has a young girl with her granddaughter. And so she's angry, and she accuses Drew's father, Bryce Campbell, the lawyer, of taking a bribe from the insurance company because he hasn't been able to get much of a settlement for her. And Drew doesn't really trust her father. She totally thinks he's unethical. And she's in a position where she really doesn't know who to trust. She's kind of got a chip on her shoulder. She's suspicious. But at the same time, you know, people ask me if my characters are me. And I think in all my protagonists, they have a little bit of my DNA because I wrote the book. And I don't have very much in common at all with Drew, except I think for, and maybe I, you know, I was a newspaper reporter for 14 years, and I really have this sense of wanting justice for people. I hate unfairness, and I hate when the underdog is somebody who's trampled on. And I think Drew has that very much.
You said she was very suspicious of her father.
Yes.
Her father, though, as you come to find out later on in the book, part of it is he married one of her friends from high school.
He married her worst junior high. He married her worst junior high frenemy, her former best friend turned junior high frenemy. So now Drew comes to work her first day at the law firm and is introduced to the office manager, who turns out to be her new stepmother, the junior high frenemy.
And it was interesting to me because Wendy almost hit the nail on the head. She said, you know, you're going to have to get over the fact that you're 36 years old with daddy issues.
Right. Yeah, we all have to get over that fact.
And, you know, Drew's dad has been keeping up this cottage for all of these years that she had no idea about.
Right.
So he can't be too bad a guy.
He was an interesting character to write about because I kept seeing him from Drew's point of view as the guy who cheated on her mother, the guy who married someone, a second stepmother who was really horrible to her. But then again, I had to think about who goes into personal injury law. And I did a lot of research for this book, talked to several personal injury lawyers. And when you sort of cut away from all the flamboyance and the ambulance chasing and the advertising and the all of that, hopefully sometimes you find someone who got into that line of law because they want to help someone fight the big guys. They want to help fight big insurance companies and big corporations and big government on behalf of their clients.
Now, you also had to do research on Drew's kiteboarding, too, right? Because, I mean, yeah. I would never kiteboard. But
no, I would. I tell people I'm the least sporty person they've ever met. So, yeah, I interviewed some kiteboarders. One of my oldest friends from St. Pete's son is a kiteboarder. He's a former professional kiteboarder. I was interested talking to women kiteboarders about what it's like to be a woman in that very male-dominated sport, how you deal with the sexual harassment and the other things that come up in that. Well, they come up in all kinds of sports for women, but in that one in particular, where kiteboarding tends to be kind of a macho sport from what I understand. So, you know, I watched some videos and I talked to some kiteboarders, read some kiteboarding magazines. So the one thing I didn't do was kiteboard.
Oh, I don't blame you for that. It looks physically taxing.
Yeah.
I mean, the times that I've watched it, it's fascinating, but it also looks like it's hard and that it would hurt.
Terrifying.
Which is what happens to Drew.
Yeah.
And she bangs up her knee and then she can't do what she wants to do at that point.
Yeah. My editor was funny. She said, why do you want to write about the sport? And I said, it isn't that sport in particular I'm interested in. I'm interested in what happens to a woman when her passion is taken away from her. The thing that she's loved her whole life, trained for from the time she was a young kid. What happens when a sudden injury takes that away from her? How does she deal with that? How does she deal with the fact that her body has betrayed her? And so that was kind of what I was interested in thinking about for Drew.
Drew moves back, as you've said, to Sunset Beach, and she moves into Pappy's cottage.
Yes.
How much fun is it to design where these people are going to be living?
That's my favorite part. Every time I think I am not going to write about somebody fixing up a beat-up old house, but I enjoy it. My readers tell me they enjoy it. Armchair decorating, I guess. And so this is a pretty humble cottage. Her grandfather built it out of leftover building materials. He scrounged from other building sites and whatever was left over from the cigar factory. But her grandfather built it himself. It hasn't weathered the decades very well. But the condition of the cottage becomes important to the plot of the book because the roof has been damaged in a recent hurricane. She can't afford to have it fixed, so there's literally a blue tarp covering that roof. One night, the ceiling springs a leak. She goes up to the attic to see if she can figure out where the leak is and see if she can figure out a way to stop it. And I had some fun with that. When she goes up to the attic, the first thing she finds is a kid's plastic wading pool. And that came directly from real life experience. We bought an old beach cottage on Tybee Island outside of Savannah. And we went upstairs to the attic, pulled down the steps of the attic, and went up to look around when we were inspecting the house. And there was a child's plastic wading pool up there, catching leaks in the roof.
Did you have any idea that there was even a problem with the roof?
We knew that the roof, you know, would probably need replacing soon, but we'd no idea that there was a wading pool up there. And of course, as soon as we replaced the roof, a hurricane came and took it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, within a month.
Now, did that happen in St. Pete? You know, that last big hurricane that came through?
Oh yeah.
So that really would have been
sure
devastating in a lot of that area.
Right, yeah.
Especially to some of those older hotels that you've described in the book.
Yeah.
Especially the one where Jasmine was murdered.
Right, yeah. I sort of try to deal with what's happened in the setting of the book. So it made sense that there would be hurricane damage to her cottage. And then I just sort of build the hotels and the houses of my imagination. But it's based in real life. Sunset Beach used to be very humble places of little tiny cottages. Now there are a couple of high-rise condo places. And, of course, the cottages are being torn down and big waterfront mansions are being built because it's gulffront property.
Good for some, but I think it's really bad for the people who are there all the time. And Drew touches a little bit on that,
yeah.
You know, how much it's changed since she was there because she's in between these two mansions now.
Right.
In her little tiny cottage that has a blue tarp across the roof.
And no air conditioning.
Oh, yeah. That would kill me. I don't know how she did that. I really don't.
Can you tell I've lived in a couple of houses without air conditioning?
Oh, and you actually have a couple of cottages, right?
They're vacation rental houses now, but we restored both of them and we're there whenever we can be and whenever we can't. We have them in a vacation rental program.
So you definitely could relate to what Drew is going through as she starts to rip out old carpet.
Sure.
You know, paint walls, all that kind of
stuff.
Well, how did you decide what Pappy's hobby would be after he retired? Because I couldn't imagine him painting and the things that he painted, too.
My husband had an uncle who retired from working in the steel mills in western Pennsylvania. And in his retirement, he took early retirement because he had some kind of heart trouble. He painted paint by numbers. And he painted them by the dozens and dozens. Now, we don't have any of his paint-by-number paintings, but I just thought it would be appropriate. And he paints exotic birds to start with, and I think he paints flowers, and then he moves on to maybe dogs. And I'll tell you, I collect vintage paint-by-number paintings and have them in my beach cottages.
That's interesting. Now, how did you get into that?
I just like vintage Floridiana. And so I like the old paintings of egrets and flamingos and herons. And that's kind of a recurring motif in my houses. And the heron motif is a continuing one in Sunset Beach.
Okay.
So there's a heron on the cover of the book. And that came about because when I was writing the book, I was down at the next beach over from Sunset Beach. I rented a cottage and stayed down there working on the book. I always try to embed myself in the setting of a book so I get myself physically in the world of the book. And then I know what happens and I know how the setting of the book affects my characters. So every day I would go out at sunset. I love sunsets. And I would go out and sit and watch the sunset and sip a glass of wine, you know, wind down my day of writing. One day there was a beautiful, either a blue or gray heron. I can't really tell the difference. And I was stalking it as it was stalking something in the shallow waves. And so the heron was moving down the beach, and I was moving down with it, edging closer and closer to take its picture.
And so you use that with Drew in the book.
I use that
Drew's
with Drew in the book,
looking
yeah.
for the perfect photo.
Right. And then that heron comes back later on in the book.
And we've talked about, you know, there's the disappearance and there's the murder. Was it difficult to write about two very different times as far as investigating how they would have investigated Colleen's disappearance versus Jasmine's murder?
Yeah, I had to trot out my journalism skills all over again. I tracked down a retired St. Pete police detective, long retired. He's probably in his 80s now. He was a patrol officer in St. Pete in the 70s. And I talked to him about, well, what's it like when you go out on a domestic call? What do you wear on your police belt? You know, what happens in the cruiser? Who calls you out? I knew that I was going to have an important scene set at a, what they call a hot sheet motel, a no-tell motel. And I had a specific kind of motel in mind. And of course, he was helpful because he told me the exact names of those hotels.
Wow.
Where they used to get called out. And so while I was talking to him, I mentioned that my late uncle had been a career police officer in St. Pete and actually had retired from there as acting chief of police. And he asked me my uncle's name. And I told him, and he said he was my boss.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He's told
what
me
a coincidence.
Yeah, he told me a couple of anecdotes about working for my uncle. So it was really helpful. And then, of course, I had to write about current day police procedure with the murder of Jasmine in the hotel and had to figure out a way how to intertwine those two stories, cutting back and forth from the 70s when Colleen disappears into the present day when Jasmine's body is found. And kind of, I think, is an interesting side note to the Colleen story is it was inspired by a real true crime story in Atlanta. Probably the most notorious, still cold, never solved case in Atlanta happened in 1965. And even though I joined the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the 80s, I heard about this story from the time I joined the newspaper. So in 1965, there was a 22-year-old newlywed. Her name was Mary Shotwell Little. And she went shopping at Lenox Shopping Center, which is later became Lenox Square Mall, one of the premier malls in the Southeast. In those days, in 1965, it was a nice shopping center in Buckhead, a very nice part of Atlanta. She went shopping with a friend, had dinner that evening. They walked out to the parking lot, and Mary Little said to her friend, "I'll see you tomorrow." And then she vanished. Nobody's ever seen or had a credible sighting of Mary Shotwell Little since that night. The next day, they found her car in the shopping center parking lot with some bloody clothing that was hers, but no sign in all that time. And so in the 80s, when it was a very cold case, I did some reporting on it. I talked to the investigator. He'd been the head investigator on the story from the beginning, and he was just about to retire in 88 or 89. And so I talked to him about it, and it was his obsession. He said some nights he couldn't sleep thinking about what had happened to Mary Shotwell Little. When I was researching police procedure for Sunset Beach, I was interviewing a retired police detective who joined the force much later, but he knew this captain who had retired. And we were chatting about it and what his theory of the case was. And my friend Mick said, you know, when this captain retired, shortly afterwards, the whole Mary Shotwell case file disappeared. And of course, the family says, well, he didn't take it with him. But of course, people on the police department always assumed and believed that this captain took the case when he left, intending to keep investigating it in retirement to figure out what happened. And so when my friend told me that story about the missing case file, I had a light bulb moment. And I thought, I'm going to find that file and I'm going to use it in my story. So that's kind of what I did.
And that is what Drew finds when she goes up to the attic,
right,
along with the plastic wading pool.
Yes.
And
yes,
it makes her even more curious because she can't figure out why. First of all, her mom has all of these newspaper clippings, and then she finds the police file.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
Yeah.
That makes her even more suspicious of her dad.
Yeah.
And everything about him.
And her father, you know, doesn't help matters by brushing off her inquiries into it. He admits that he'd gone to high school with Colleen, but that they knew each other only in a marginal kind of way. He got out of high school and went to Vietnam, and that was it. But, of course, we come to find out that's not really the entire truth.
Well, now, most of your books are characterized as beach books.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, to me, it means it's a fast read and it's escape. It takes my readers to a place they might want to go, usually the beach, sometimes not. I don't agree with the idea that beach reads are cotton candy, strictly empty calories. I want my stories to have some meaning, and that's why lots of times, especially in the last three novels, I've included a mystery, a murder mystery, in the plot of the book. But I think a beach read is just a fast, compelling read with characters that you care about and that keep you turning the pages. And for me, with a beach read, I forget where I am when I'm reading it. You know, at the end of the day, you've got a sunburn or a beach book hangover.
And they're not chick lit either, you know.
Right.
Because these books, especially with this murder mystery and the disappearance and everything.
Hey, I'm fine with chick lit. But in a lot of those books, the protagonist is trying to find romance or a job or a great pair of shoes. But in my books, my characters are trying to find themselves or trying to figure out how to reinvent themselves.
And Drew is really doing that. I mean, she's had to start from scratch all over again. It's just that chip on her shoulder.
Yeah, she's a hot mess.
Yeah, she really is. But a very interesting character.
I hope so.
And all of those people, like Ray Hernandez, the current police officer that's investigating the murder.
Yes.
She's such a real person.
I really enjoyed writing Ray Hernandez. I wanted her to be just as prickly as Drew and just as reluctant to talk to her. And I really enjoyed having her be a working mom who's got a kid who's playing Little League. And she's so prickly that she gets kicked off the field for questioning the umpire's calls.
Well, now, what is your process? Do you write all day long when you start a new book?
Writers talk about there are two kinds of writers people think, a plotter or a pantser. I'm probably a plotzer. I start with a synopsis, and that's basically the blueprint of what I think my story's going to be. I know my protagonist, or I try to know my protagonist. I know who she is and what she wants and why she can't get what she wants and what she has to do by the end of the story to get what she wants and how she's changed, because they have to change or you have no story arc. So I start with a synopsis, and then I'm a linear writer. I write in a linear way. If I get an idea for a scene that's out of sequence, I'll kind of sketch it out and tuck it aside. But otherwise, I write in a pretty linear way. I don't do what I consider multiple drafts like a lot of other writers I know. I try to write beginning to end without backing up too much. And I don't write all day every day because that's just not possible in my world. I do a lot of marketing. We do a lot of social media. I'm on tour right now, starting the second week of a 5-week book tour. So I've been on the road for a week and I can't write on the road. So I've started working on next summer's book. When I get off the road, I'll get back to that. And the closer it gets to deadline time, the harder and faster I write. Deadline is in October. When deadline gets close, then I put the laptop in bed with me or beside the bed. And when I wake up in the morning, I grab my laptop before the day grabs me.
Is there a writing quirk?
Yeah, I think, I'm Irish and I'm superstitious. So yeah, I definitely have my little weird rituals. I start drafting on a yellow legal pad, or this time around I've started with Sunset Beach. I used all school composition books. I don't know what happened that I switched from my usual yellow legal pad. I need a fine point felt tip pen. I start out writing, and when I start out drafting every day, I write on one margin of the paper the date. And on the other margin, I write where I am when I'm writing. So if I'm writing on Tybee Island at ebb tide, one of our cottages, I write ebb tide. If I'm writing at home, I write, you know, Avondale, and I name everything. I guess that's the writer in me. Our house in Atlanta is called Squirrel Hollow, so we have a lot of squirrels. I burn, my favorite aromatherapy candle is a red currant candle to sort of put myself in the mood. When the story is starting to flow, then I'll switch over to my laptop, and I'll, you know, start typing into the laptop, and I don't do a save on it until I've written 500 words.
Oh, wow.
It's not real until I've written 500 words, and then I'll save the chapter and name the chapter.
That sounds risky to me.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm living on the edge or what, but I feel like
it's too much commitment. And actually, it's kind of like, okay, go, 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 go. It's egging me on to say, okay, 500 words. When you get 500 words, you can save it. You can name it. Maybe you get up and go get a glass of water or walk around the house. I have an Apple Watch that now tells me time to stand up. So yeah, I have all these really odd little quirks that I have developed over the years.
But it works, and that's the good thing for all of us.
I hope it works. I never know. I never know if the story is working or not. And then the other thing I do that not a lot of writers I know indulge in is I have my editor and my agent reading over my shoulder. So most writers write a draft and submit it, and I write maybe 50 pages or 100 pages and ask my editor and agent to let me know what they think. All I really want from them is keep going. I don't want them to pick the manuscript apart at that point.
Do you revise at that point?
Not unless my editor says this is absolutely not working. With Sunset Beach, originally Jasmine had a much younger child, and he was a little boy. And my editor, for her own reasons, said, I want her to be older and I want it to be a little girl. So that was an easy thing to fix. So when my day's writing is done, I try for 2,000 words. Lots of times if it's going well, I'll exceed that. But 2,000 words is a respectable day's output. I'll think about it at night, and then I'll go back in the morning and I might revise lightly. But I don't believe in polishing, polishing, polishing. And I have a motto that I always tell my writing pals, and when beginning writers ask me, you know, if I have any words of advice, my words of advice are this: you can't fix what you ain't wrote. So if you keep going back and polishing something and making it the most perfect jewel-like paragraph, that's all you'll have. You'll just have one perfect jewel-like paragraph. And editors and publishers don't publish jewel-like paragraphs. They publish stories and books. So I race to the end of my story. I revise some as I go. But then after I have my story down, then I can go back. My editor gives me a revision letter. Then I can go back and I can make it pretty.
And once from that draft version to the final, how long does all that take?
When my editor gets the entire manuscript, it's a pretty fast turnaround. She'll give me a revision letter. Sometimes she'll read it overnight and maybe give two or three days later, giving me a revision letter. And then sometimes I might, depending how much I've blown deadline by, I might only have 2 weeks to turn it around with the revisions.
How long have you had the same editor?
We have been together for 10 years and 10 books now, I think.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because that way she knows you, you know her.
Yeah. It's
you
a really.
Know her instincts are going to be there for you.
I think people have a misunderstanding to me about the editor-writer relationship. And it's not one of these things where she's the boss. We're collaborating. I trust her taste and I trust her instincts. And I wouldn't be working with her if I didn't. And she wouldn't have signed me to a contract if she didn't trust my taste and my instincts. So we both know, we might disagree about some things, but we both know that we both want the same thing. We both want the best book possible, and that I'll do whatever it takes to make that book what it needs to be.
I appreciate your time today.
It's great to be with you.
And good luck with the rest of your tour.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've reached the end of our time for today's Book Talk. I've been speaking with Mary Kay Andrews, author of Sunset Beach, a summer pick by Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Pop Sugar. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.